This is The Takeaway for Monday, October 2nd, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. American tragedy and terror in Las Vegas. Overnight, a gunman opened fire into a crowd enjoying an outdoor country music festival. As concertgoers drank and watched the stage, hundreds of shots rang out. Officials have confirmed at least 58 people dead and more than 500 injured in the deadliest mass shooting in American history. Earlier today, President Trump spoke from the White House.
My fellow Americans, we are joined together today in sadness, shock, and grief. Last night, a gunman opened fire on a large crowd at a country music concert in Las Vegas, Nevada. He brutally murdered more than 50 people and wounded hundreds more. It was an act of pure evil. The FBI and the Department of Homeland Security are working closely with local authorities to assist with the investigation, and they will provide updates as to the investigation and how it develops.
The president said he'll be visiting Las Vegas on Wednesday. So here's a quick recap of what we know so far. The first reported shots came just after 10 p.m. local time Sunday night as thousands of people attended the last day of the Route 91 Harvest Festival outside the Mandalay Bay Hotel on the Las Vegas Strip. Officials say the gunman shot down onto the crowd from the 32nd floor of the hotel, sending people panicked and running from the grounds. Early Monday morning, police identified the shooter.
His name is Stephen Paddock, last name spelled P-A-D-D-O-C-K, with the date of birth of 4-9 of 1953.
A 64-year-old man from Mesquite, Nevada.
We located numerous firearms within the room that he occupied, and that's, like I stated earlier, it's going to be a long and tedious investigation.
We go now to Sally Ho, reporter for the Associated Press. She's in Las Vegas. Sally, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Sally, you have spoken, I'm sure, with several of the victims and people around Las Vegas after this horrible massacre. What's the reaction been like? What are people saying?
The AP has spoken to tons and tons of people on the streets, who are at the concert, and even in the nearby casinos who, you know, had to witness the people coming in. And frankly, it's very jarring to hear the eyewitness account. There were an estimated 22,000 people who were there enjoying what Vegas does best, which is live entertainment. And the ones we talked to, you know, they described enjoying this outdoor country music festival. It's the third day, the last show at the Route 93 Harvest Festival down on this dirt lot on the far southern end of the Las Vegas Strip. And, you know, they're talking about the music's playing and then it suddenly stops and then it actually even starts up again. And all they hear, you know, they hear this noise of, and this really sits with me, is, you know, they describe hearing pop, 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 pop. And then they kind of don't know what's going on, kind of surprised. Even the people on stage are surprised. And, you know, some people said it sounded like a bottle breaking or fireworks starting, which, you know, neither would be out of the ordinary for an event like this. But they also described seeing flash, 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 flash coming from when they look up at this golden tower, the Mandalay Bay casino and hotel, and you know, they're witnessing and experiencing with their senses, their eyes and their ears, that this is coming, that these gunshots are coming from across the street, down on them, and raining bullets. But they don't really know what's really happening because, you know, they're kind of just enjoying the day and things like that. And then they see people drop dead or bloodied, and that's when it's really, you know, the chaos has kind of set in. Everybody's running out. You see couples wearing cowboy boots and cowboy hats, holding hands, running really in every direction because they probably don't know what's, you know, up from down because it's so such a jarring experience. And you see people confused and crying and shocked and screaming. And just a lot of trauma. And all the while, you know, I think they're, when they talk to us, they're looking back and they're grasping themselves as they speak to us that they've just endured the largest mass shooting in modern U.S. history.
And you're describing a scene of panic and mayhem, Sally Ho, after an event like this. We heard some reports in the panic as people ran onto an airport tarmac or a hangar area, and reports of some people even being trampled in the panic.
This was 22,000 people, and they were more or less caged in, you know, this fenced area. It was created. If you go on a normal, you know, Tuesday night, there's nothing there. This was a open space, you know, the stage was built there and things like that. So, you know, there's bound to be a lot of pushing and shoving and trying to figure out. I actually heard from more than one person, more than one witness, who said that it was chaotic, but it was actually fairly organized because, you know, there was just a lot of, I think, shock. People were just, you know, laser focused on finding an exit for themselves and trying to get out. And as far as the airport, I mean, the airport, you can literally probably even see it from this location. It's extremely, extremely close. So it does not surprise me that people would have ended up at the airport or near the airport, because there's just not a whole lot of places to go.
Sally Ho, what do we know about the suspect so far? His name, according to police, is Stephen Paddock from Mesquite, Nevada. Do police know anything about his planning, his intent, his motive, or whether he acted alone?
They have not discussed a motive. They do believe he acted alone. They've called him, you know, the primary aggressor and the sole aggressor in this. And I don't forget, it's been less than 12 hours since this actually happened. But initially, they were looking for a woman who they thought was his roommate in Mesquite. And they considered her a person of interest, but it actually turns out she wasn't even in the country. They've cleared her. As far as his plans, you know, I mean, as intentional as it may appear, we really don't know a whole lot about motive or planning. We know he checked into this hotel as a hotel guest several days ago, last Thursday. And that's not unusual, people coming in for the weekend, you know, starting the weekend early on a Thursday. And that he was found by police, by authorities, dead. They think he killed himself inside the hotel. And he had at least 10 firearms, including rifles. What happened? I mean, he's dead. His brother has spoken out saying he's got no clue what happened. He said the brother has said the family is dumbfounded and just don't have any clue in the world. And because he's dead and gone, I mean, we may never truly know what happened. But, you know, investigators are searching now, and they're eventually, you know, maybe we'll know more, but it's possible we won't ever know all.
Well, Sally Ho with the Associated Press, we'll let you go. I do want to ask you before I do, the president has said he will visit Las Vegas on Wednesday. What kind of environment is he likely to encounter when he gets there?
I think at this point, you know, we have more than 400 people who have been hurt in some way, more than 50 people dead. I think any comfort he can provide to victims and witnesses will be appreciated by the people. I mean, don't forget, this is now the worst, largest mass shooting in modern U.S. history. And there were 22,000 people there and many, many, many thousands more who work in this environment every day, you know, the cocktail waitresses, the bartenders, the bellhops. I mean, this strip is truly the lifeblood of really the entire state. So I think his leadership and how he responds, I think Nevada is waiting for that.
Sally Ho, thank you for joining us, and thank you for your reporting there in Las Vegas.
Thank you.
Sally Ho is with the Associated Press. Let's turn now to Heather Long, who is with the Washington Post. Heather joined us a little earlier this morning from outside the suspect's home.
Residents here are just really stunned. It's a beautiful planned community in the mountains, you know, the type of place that has water fountain when you come in and nice landscape rocks and mostly white community. People are just in disbelief. I was in Las Vegas this morning at the corner. I spent the night in a hotel called the New York, one of the MGM Grand properties. I was interviewing victims this morning. A lot of people just total confusion, disbelief. Some people at the concert, a woman told me, 55-year-old woman, who got trampled, blood coming off down her knee, said that she, everyone just said that they thought it was fireworks at first. Somebody else said they'd been having trouble all weekend with the sound system, so when the gunshot started, people didn't know what it was. But then it became pretty apparent after about the first 10 shots, the lights all went out, and people just started running. The woman who got trampled said that she looked up at the Mandalay Bay and could see the green light of the gun from the window up there, and that's when, people just really went in every direction.
And the confusion and the panic during an incident like that is certainly understandable. The sun has come up on day two of this tragedy now, Heather Long. You're in Mesquite, the hometown of the suspect. Remind us a little bit about who police think he is, his profile, and what they're doing at his home now.
They're doing what reporters are doing. They're trying to figure out who this guy is. 64-year-old. My understanding, he was recently on parole, so whether this was a violation of parole to have all these guns with him at the time. So everyone's just trying to get a better sense of who this person is.
That was Heather Long, reporter for The Washington Post, on the ground in Nevada. And you've been calling us with your reaction and your voice after this horrific shooting.
This is Beverly calling from Waukegan, Illinois. I just want to say that with all of these mass shootings, as horrible and as terrible as they are, my heart goes out to all of the victims and their families. But nobody is addressing the real issue. And the real issue is the readily accessible ability of guns. Guns are everywhere in this country. This man had an arsenal in his hotel room.
My name is Karen. I'm calling from Saxon's River, Vermont. And I just wanted to say, in regard to the shooting last night in Las Vegas, that it seems every year or so we break the record for the worst mass shooting in the United States history. And when are we going to have the gun laws reflect reality? This is just so pathetic.
Kristen's from Mukilteo. This is so sad. My heart feels heavy for everyone there. I'd like to see this springboard into a discussion on how America will finally address gun regulation, but I know that won't happen. We'll just be stuck witnessing tragedy after tragedy.
Your reactions to last night's tragic events in Las Vegas, you can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also join this conversation by visiting our Facebook page. We have a break coming up, and then we'll go back to Puerto Rico to give you the latest on the devastation there. We are staying with that story. So stay with us.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for businesses, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy-and-print. Staples, it's pro time. This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
It's a difficult day of news here on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. We appreciate you being with us as we cover the tragedy in Las Vegas. And let's return now to Puerto Rico, where 12 days after Hurricane Maria, residents are still dealing with widespread power outages and long lines for food, for water, and for gasoline and other supplies as well. Emergency responses continued over the weekend, aided by the U.S. military and FEMA, but the effort is still being hampered by disorganization on the ground. The mayor of San Juan, Carmen Yulín Cruz, had this to say.
I am done being polite. I am done being politically correct. I am mad as hell. I beg you to take charge and save lives. We are dying here.
The White House has faced criticism for that lack of organization, and the president responded with tweets criticizing some officials in Puerto Rico and saying some want everything done for them. David Begno joins us now by phone from San Juan. He's a correspondent for CBS News. David, thanks for joining us once again.
Good to be with you.
David, I understand you're there without internet service yourself. What's the latest on power, gasoline, critical resources where you are?
Look, only 5% of the island has seen its electricity restored. The majority of the island is still in the dark. The majority of the island is still without power and the ability to communicate via cell phone. However, let's talk about the positive points. Lights are coming on in the city of San Juan and other larger municipalities where officials are able to reestablish some connections. We're finding out that people are making calls with landlines. Cellular communication is still nearly impossible, though.
David, what's the latest at the port where there were thousands of containers stacked up waiting for distribution and authorities were having so much trouble getting it trucked out of there to be distributed?
First of all, they've got more drivers who are driving those supplies to the store shelves where they're needed. Number two, there are still shipping containers that are sitting there waiting to be emptied of supplies. A week ago, there were 3,000. Today, there's still about 2,000 that are waiting to be processed. Here's what FEMA's doing. FEMA's going in and actually purchasing the supplies that are meant for those private companies. They're purchasing those supplies and getting them out as fast as they can.
General Jeffrey Buchanan, the three-star general in charge of this effort for the federal government, David, said himself a couple of days ago that authorities don't have enough troops and equipment to handle the logistical lift here. Is that the case, and is there a surge now of U.S. troops to be able to do more?
I went to the general within the last 24 hours, and I reminded him of what he said, and he said, you're right, I did. He said, but more is on the way. I said to the general, I said, is a three-star general satisfied that more help is still on the way 11 days after the fact? Why do you still need more help 11 days after the hurricane hit? And he said, listen, I'm not satisfied. I'm not satisfied. I could always use more. And then I went to the governor and I said, Governor, you have said every day we're doing as much as we can, but more needs to be done. I said, what more do you need in order to move this out of the emergency phase? And he talked about, I need personnel. I need financial assistance. And then he perhaps was the most candid he has been since the hurricane hit. And I've interviewed him every day. He put both hands on the podium. He lowered his voice and he essentially said, if Congress doesn't pass a financial aid package soon, there will be a mass exodus of Puerto Ricans to the U.S. mainland.
And David Begno, you mentioned lights coming back on in San Juan and some of the larger towns around Puerto Rico. We've talked so much about the interior, the mountainous area, and the smaller towns. What's the situation there?
In the dark. We went to Utuado yesterday. Store shelves are bare. There's no bread. There's no water. None of the essentials. People are still bathing themselves in creeks and streams and from water that's dripping off the side of the mountains. There's no running water, no power, and neighbors are helping neighbors. In and around Utuado, one of the local leaders had set up a water filtration system. So when you hear that Puerto Ricans need to do more to help themselves, know that we have seen it happening across this island.
You mentioned people hearing that Puerto Ricans need to do more for themselves, and you're echoing the words or the tweets of the president of the United States, who said that some in Puerto Rico want everything done for them. David Begno, for people on the mainland, a lot of this has turned into a PR war, a press war between the president and anyone who criticizes him. Is that media skirmish reaching the people on the ground in Puerto Rico?
I have not met one Puerto Rican on the ground here who has mentioned the president of the United States. The only thing they mention is, I need more. I need more water. I need more food. Every mayor we've talked to says, I need more supplies. I need more from FEMA. I need more from the private sector. No one has mentioned the president.
So what needs to happen now, this day, this Monday, David, tomorrow, Tuesday, the most urgent needs, what needs to go on?
It's the question no one can seem to answer, because every press conference every day with the officials starts the same way. We hope today is a better day than yesterday, but it's still an important day. It's the same thing that they've been trumpeting since day one. I keep asking them, what do you need in order to move this past the emergency phase? And you get a runaround sort of answer. That's just the truth.
David Begno, correspondent for CBS News on the ground in San Juan. David, we appreciate your reporting.
You bet.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And as we just heard, aid is arriving in Puerto Rico in response to Hurricane Maria. But 12 days later, organization and distribution are still major problems. President Trump defended his administration's response in Puerto Rico numerous times over the weekend and at the president's golf club tournament in New Jersey.
We've saved a lot of lives. We've done a really good job, and now we're bringing the people for distribution.
Jeremy Kolniedyk has a different view. He's the former head of U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance under the Obama administration and currently a senior policy fellow at the Center for Global Development. Over the weekend, Jeremy tweeted that the Trump administration's response so far in Puerto Rico has been disaster management malpractice.
That was particularly referring to the White House's management of this. It was very much my experience when I was in government that the tone set by the president was vital to orienting the overall response, particularly in something like this, which is so difficult and complex. And so the closest analogy I could draw from my experience would be the Ebola outbreak, where that too came on the heels of several other major events. In that case, the potential famine in South Sudan and Iraq falling apart after Mosul fell and the group of Yazidis were trapped on Sinjar Mountain. So that happened when we had our hands very full and, you know, felt at that point like we were doing all we could. But the reality was it was not proving to be enough. And it really took the leadership of our agency and the president himself saying to us, this is where the priority sits and whatever you need, we will throw at this problem and we will fix it. So to think about this event in those terms, and referring specifically to that Washington Post report that came out Friday night, Saturday morning, about how the president spent that first weekend, you know, the malpractice, in my view, was the fact that the White House appeared to really take its eye off the ball in those first days of this. That was the period where they needed to be identifying exactly what do we have on our hands here, and what do we need to be throwing at it. And they did eventually start doing that. From what the reporting says, it appears that process didn't start until Tuesday, which was 6 days after the storm made landfall. So you do have to wonder how much further along this would be had they started accelerating it much earlier and, you know, had the White House and the president himself been paying closer attention over the weekend.
So is that time lag that you're talking about, is that what accounts now for this dual situation that we appear to have, which are reports of lots and lots, tons and tons of aid arriving in Puerto Rico, but in many cases, it's just not getting to many of the towns and villages that need it?
I think that would likely be in better shape had they accelerated earlier. You know, that is a distribution logistics challenge, and it's not unusual in an island environment in particular that you face huge logistical difficulties moving things around. And so, you know, the classic sort of chain here is you need to clear the ports so you can get stuff in, and you need to then clear the inland distribution channels so that you can move stuff out. And that's where airlift becomes so important. And, you know, it's a little hard to tell from some of the official reporting from FEMA and DOD just how much they're doing in terms of airlift. They reference it, but they're not talking about we did X number of sorties a day, at least not anywhere that I've seen.
Meanwhile, Jeremy, the message from the top, from the president, at least publicly, while all of this goes on, has been a skirmish with the mayor of San Juan, criticism for authorities in Puerto Rico, while praising the federal response. In your experience, and maybe you didn't experience anything quite like this, is the president arguing with people on Twitter at a time like this? Is it helpful? Is it unhelpful or irrelevant to the overall operation?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say I never experienced anything like this under President Obama. It's deeply unhelpful. And I thought that, you know, some of the things you're hearing out of the FEMA administrator and out of the governor of Puerto Rico set the tone much better, which was to say, we are doing a great deal. We are working very hard, but we know it's not yet enough. And I think that's the message here. When the response is inadequate, if the president is saying inadequate, that sends the wrong tone, both to the people who are affected and to the, you know, the people who are working for him.
Jeremy Kolniedyk, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jeremy Kolniedyk was the head of U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance in the Obama administration. You're hearing sounds there of violent clashes in Spain on Sunday as the autonomous region of Catalonia held a referendum vote for independence. Hundreds of people were injured as the National Police Force in riot gear descended on polling stations, overturning tables and destroying ballots. Here to explain what happened and what to expect in the wake of the vote is Rafael Minder. He's Spain correspondent for The New York Times and also author of the book, The Struggle for Catalonia. Rafael, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Well, Rafael, we saw reports and video of these clashes at polling places. Many of them turned violent. Was this type of confrontation expected on polling day in Catalonia?
It wasn't expected to be violent, for sure. The idea that the police would step in and prevent the vote was expected, in the sense that Catalans had been warned. They were getting ahead of themselves. They were staging an illegal referendum, according to the Madridian government and the Constitutional Court. But obviously the fact that they intervened using the police in a very forceful way with riot gear, and that this ended up provoking some very ugly images, as well as leaving people injured, that wasn't expected. And that's a pretty big shock for people who've lived in this fairly young but stable democracy for 50 years.
And how are people across Spain and Catalans themselves reacting to the scene over the weekend?
I think in your question, there's two very different reactions. I think in the rest of Spain, people are probably welcoming the sign and proof that the government is firm, that it believes in the rule of law, that it doesn't let Catalans flout the constitution. In Catalonia, for sure, people are pretty shocked. They went in to vote knowing that it would be tough for that vote to mean very much, but they didn't think that their own personal safety was at risk.
And what does that vote mean now? I mean, it seemed pretty clear that the vote from Catalans themselves would overwhelmingly approve independence. That might be tough to verify given the clashes, but even if that's the case, what does it mean going forward?
Well, that's anyone's guess, really. There's a very conflicting interpretation. Catalans say this gives them a mandate to perhaps even declare unilateral independence later this week. The Madrid government says that there was no referendum as such. It's illegal. And Catalan separatists should know that they're in a situation of insurgency, facing very tough sanctions, starting with suspension from office. So it's not that the vote settled anything, far from it. And obviously it was a one-way vote. I mean, the result makes it look overwhelming, 90% in favor, but the people who are against independence boycotted the vote. So we don't actually know from this vote what Catalans want.
And what is the Catalan government prepared to do to leave Spain now? And the corollary is, what is Spain prepared to do to prevent it?
Well, what the Catalans will do, we'll have to wait a little bit. They have now essentially to spend the next 48 hours deciding whether they really want to make this vote binding and declare unilateral independence. What the Spanish government will do is step in, and they will most likely use their emergency powers to seize back full administrative control of Catalonia, which would be the equivalent of moving into a state like California and, you know, getting the governor out of his office. So that's what's facing us, a very uncertain time, and definitely no clear answers as to whether Catalans are closer to independence than they were before yesterday's vote.
And you mentioned that across Spain, outside of Catalonia, most Spanish people overwhelmingly would support that kind of, well, I'll call it a crackdown from Madrid.
Yeah, they would definitely not see it as a crackdown. They would see it as imposing the rule of law and imposing the constitution, which they see as worthy of protection as Americans consider the American constitution. And yes, they would certainly, they don't feel that the Catalans have a mandate to speak even on behalf of their own people and just walk away.
Rafael Minder, Spain correspondent for The New York Times, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Welcome back, everybody. Todd Zwillick with you. It's the first Monday in October, and that means the Supreme Court is back in session. There is a docket full of big cases ready for the fall of 2017. Well, just last week, justices canceled oral arguments in the travel ban case after President Trump issued a new set of restrictions. That doesn't mean they won't hear the case eventually. It just means that lawyers on both sides have to file new briefs addressing the changes from the White House. Also on Thursday, the court agreed to hear a case challenging the constitutionality of fees paid to public sector unions, and that could be bad news for organized labor. But let's get a rundown now of some of the most important cases coming up for the court in this new session. Amy Howe is here to help us out. Amy is one of the co-founders of SCOTUS Blog, and she begins with Gill versus Whitford. It's a case from Wisconsin scheduled for oral argument tomorrow that could affect how parties exercise political power across the country.
The allegation is that the Republicans engaged in what's known as partisan gerrymandering, drawing the districts to favor Republicans. And this is something that the Supreme Court has looked at over the years. But back in 2004, in a case out of Pennsylvania, the justices declined to get involved in the case. There were 9 justices at the time, a slightly different makeup from what we have on the Supreme Court today. And 4 of them said that courts should never get involved reviewing allegations of partisan gerrymandering. 4, the court's former liberal justices at the time said, of course, courts should get involved in partisan gerrymandering. And the 9th justice was Justice Anthony Kennedy, who said that we don't want to rule out the idea that courts can rule on partisan gerrymandering cases, but I don't think we should get involved because so far we haven't come up with a workable standard to figure out exactly how you judge claims of partisan gerrymandering. And so that is really at the core of what the Supreme Court will be looking at, is not simply whether this was a case of partisan gerrymandering, but is this the sort of thing that courts can get involved in at all?
Could this case impact how districts are drawn throughout the country, all these strangely shaped congressional districts you see in states around the country?
Depending on what the Supreme Court says, it certainly could. If the Supreme Court were to say, we're not going to get involved in partisan gerrymandering right now, then it would really give states something close to carte blanche to draw districts however they wanted. And the thing about partisan gerrymandering is that if you have one party in control of the legislature and they get to draw the districts, they can draw the districts in a way that will make it incredibly difficult for the other party to take over and have its own shot at drawing the districts. On the other hand, if the Supreme Court were to rule that courts can get involved in partisan gerrymandering cases just the way that they can in racial gerrymandering cases, they're going to have to come up with a way to judge whether or not a district has been partisan gerrymandered. And it could embroil the courts in really, you know, looking at each and every redistricting plan over and over again, which is something I think that the court will be reluctant to do. But either way, there's going to be an impact on how states draw their districts in the future.
Amy, there's a long-awaited case coming out of Colorado and the rights of a cake shop owner to refuse to make a cake for a gay wedding.
That's right. The rationale in Masterpiece Cake Shop, the case out of Colorado, is that the baker in this case who refused to make a custom wedding cake for a same-sex couple, that this violated his religious beliefs. He's a deeply religious person who, he tells the Supreme Court, practices his Christian faith by being closed on Sundays, refusing to make cakes themed for Halloween or cakes that contain alcohol. But the atmospherics are certainly very interesting, particularly because the federal government did file a brief in this case in which it defended the cake shop owner and offered a fairly narrow ground for the cake shop owner to win. It said that certainly not everyone who has anything to do with weddings, for example, can refuse to provide services to a same-sex couple just because they don't believe in same-sex marriage. But here, this cake shop owner calls himself a cake artist. He is expressing himself. The state government shouldn't require him to express himself in a way that violates his religious beliefs.
We've seen the increasing use of religious freedom claims across the culture and cases that have reached the Supreme Court. Hobby Lobby, as it related to Obamacare, was one issue. There were certainly religious freedom claims brought up when it came to same-sex marriage and the Obergefell case. And this seems like another example of that strategy.
It is, and it's a very interesting intersection of sort of 2 lines of cases. You've got, on one hand, same-sex marriage in the Obergefell decision a couple of years ago, and then on the other hand, religious freedom. And so Justice Anthony Kennedy, of course, is sort of the author of many of the Supreme Court's most important decisions involving gay rights and same-sex marriage. But on the other hand, he was in the 5-justice majority in the Hobby Lobby case a few years ago. And that was a case in which the Supreme Court ruled that a corporation owned by a deeply religious family couldn't be required to provide its female employees with health insurance that includes access to birth control. So 2 very important issues are colliding in this case, and it will be interesting to see how it plays out.
There's a Fourth Amendment case finally, Amy, coming before the court, Carpenter v. the United States, sort of the ongoing concern over search and seizure and cell phone records.
Carpenter is a slightly more straightforward case. It involves what are known as cell site records. When your cell phone is on and you're traveling around the country, it's constantly connecting with cell towers. And this is something that your cell phone company keeps records of, in part so that it can figure out where the gaps are in its coverage. It can figure out whether or not it needs to charge you those really large roaming fees. But this was a case in which Carpenter was under investigation for participating in a series of armed robberies, and the police were able to use his cell phone records to put him in the vicinity of the robberies, and he was ultimately convicted. And so the question under the Supreme Court's old rules was something called the third-party doctrine, that you don't have an interest in information that you've shared with other people, in this case, your cell phone company, which is the one that's actually collecting the records. And so the question is whether or not that is going to make the police's use of Carpenter's cell phone records constitutional, or are we going to have to sort of rethink how some of these older Supreme Court cases apply to new technology?
A packed docket at the Supreme Court for the fall session of 2017. Amy Howe, co-founder of the great SCOTUS blog, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
It's Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway. Thanks for being with us. You know, the United States has always struggled with questions of identity. Who's American enough or American at all? You can see it behind so many of the stories in the news that we're following today. There's uncertainty over the future of DACA recipients, debates over patriotism and protest, tension over the monuments that symbolize America's dark past. Well, we're not the only country that grapples with history and reconciliation in this way. Italian-Somalian novelist and journalist Ijaba Shego explores these themes in a new novel. It's called Adjua. It's a story that spans a long arc from the 1930s to the present day in Italy. And it explores Italy's colonial past in Africa, its immigrants, and a refugee crisis going on in real life today.
The story of Adjua is for me the story of the connection between my two worlds, Somalia and Italy. I was born in Italy from Somali parents that came here in 1970-71 when the immigration began in Italy. So this novel is not autobiography. It's not a biography, someone that I know. But for me, this is the way to show this connection between Somalia and Italy in the past with colonialism and in the present with the refugee crisis, because the characters are the same. And I choose to divide in three parts because for me, these parts are three steps of the history in common between the two countries. Colonialism is, of course, and refugees, but in the middle, we find out when in the 70s, when immigration began, when my father and my mother came in Italy.
So Adjua, your title character, is a Somali immigrant in Rome, where you are now, there for a long time, but then marries a young, recent immigrant, and it's an unusual relationship.
Yes, not so unusual in Italy, and no, I think in Europe. Titanic is the third character of the novel, and sometimes migrants, above all refugees, have to fight against the racism of the native, and sometimes to fight the racism of their own people, the people that came before and think we are better than them and we are not refugees, we are black, but not black like them. So I choose this name to show this cruelty. So the relationship between Adjua and her husband, Titanic, is a relationship of power, of course, because she tried to colonize her husband because Italian society colonized her. So it's a quite complicated relationship. It's not easy at all.
And this is a story of migration as well. Now, Italy, of course, has been an entry point for huge numbers of migrants from Africa. How is Italian society coping with that now?
It's very difficult in that moment. There is a lot of problems, I think, in the mentality of Italian society. Not Italians, because I think more politicians than the population, because a lot of parties use racism against refugees to find the vote, for example. We have a side of the society that have a lot of rights to travel, for example, to go to holiday, to get a job abroad or to study abroad, freedom to move. And the other people, like Somali people, Eritreans, Sudanese, Syrian, have a lot of problem, really, because no passport, no possibility to find a legal way to come in Europe, for example. And this is a big, big problem.
So, Ijaba Shego, Italy is in the middle of a big debate right now about how to treat the children of migrants and immigrants to their country. Do you think Italy is struggling or reconciling with its own colonial past?
The problem is this history of colonialism is a hidden history, but it's so difficult to explain colonialism in that moment. The people say, okay, it's not so important, it's past, it's okay, don't worry about this. But the problem is that, for example, in France and UK, all the people know that was an empire. Here, the Italy want to forget not only colonialism, but all the history of the fascism. But if you go around in Rome, for example, you find a lot of traces, a lot of monuments and statues in the geography of the city about colonial past. We have an area called Quartiere Africano, Africa area, not for African presence, but for colonial connection. Asmara Street, Mogadishu Street, Somalia Street, Libya Street. So it's quite interesting that people forgot all this and forgot all the exploitation, all the murders, rapes, concentration camp. This sad story is important to remember above all now, because most of refugees come from former Italian colony. So we need to understand the connection with our history.
And while this searching, this soul searching goes on in Italy, you're an author and you've written books about this too. I know they're not autobiographical, but here you are, a second-generation Italian born to Somali parents in Italy. You're Italian, but you describe how Italian society might view you as something different than, I don't know, traditional or full Italian. How do you reconcile those things?
I try to build a Black Italian history because sometimes I have a problem of My identity is a big trouble for me because I feel 100% Somali, of course, because for religion, for parents, for family. But I think I am 200% Italian and European. And my identity is something in between, of course. And for that reason, I think that I wrote my novels more for Italian than Somali, because I want that something change here around me. I'm black Italian, and I try in my literature to explain this hidden history about Black people here. It's not only colonialism, it's more than colonialism. For example, slavery in Europe, slavery in Italy. When I go around, for example, in Livorno, in Venice, in Rome too, and even in Palermo and Sicily, we find a lot of monuments about slavery, for example. So we need to understand our connection and my connection with my country, because of course, we have a lot of people look at me and look at people like me like a foreigner, but we are foreigner at all. We are. Sometimes I feel that I'm foreigner in my own nation. So it's quite sad. I don't want to be sad. For that reason, I begin to write and to explain that we are all Italians, because Italy is not white, it's not black, it's something in the middle. Here, they came Arabs, they came Spanish, French people. So a lot of people, it's mixed race, more than one, I think.
The novel is Ottawa, a story of Italy, Somalia, and migration between the two countries. Ijaba Shego is the author of Ottawa. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
President Trump made remarks in reaction to the shooting from the White House earlier today. We want to end the show with the president's remarks, where he called on Americans to unite.
In moments of tragedy and horror, America comes together as one, and it always has. Our unity cannot be shattered by evil. Our bonds cannot be broken by violence. And though we feel such great anger at the senseless murder of our fellow citizens, it is our love that defines us today and always will, forever.
We always want your thoughts and your voice on our show at any time, and especially at times of national tragedy. Weigh in by calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. I want to thank you for joining us on this dark day in America. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo, offering print products with features like Printfinity, a technology that gives the ability to print a different image on every business card. Learn more at Moo.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.